Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into football season, and all of our reports brought to you by our friends at Royal Farms. Real fresh, real fast. I got my Chicken Palooza rocking here. Still wearing the shirt out of season, even though it's the turkey season right now and the pumpkin season right now. We're letting ourselves play with the Maryland Lottery each and every week. We're doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. Black Friday leftovers with Harford County Executive Barry Glassman will be up at Conrad's Crabs in Abingdon, and then on the 3rd of December, we'll be at Pappas in the afternoon in Cockeysville, and then we begin my 30th anniversary tour and crab cake tour in Catonsville at the Beaumont. That's Thursday, December the 9th. This guy and I, we've had a beer together. I'm sure we may have had a crab cake together at some point over on the east side of town. He is the longtime baseball and then, like, writing about all sorts of things and now writes about the Olympics and has written about football. Dave Shinen lives in Baltimore but writes for the Washington Post. So if you see a guy who looks like Shinen somewhere over there near the Rofo on Fleet Street, I would say that probably is Dave Shinen. Dude, I've seen you only online. We've dined together recently, but it feels like a year ago. And you've been off to Tokyo and writing and doing different stuff. A lot more fun than watching the Orioles lose 107, right, Dave?
Man, you got that right. I still keep up with them, of course. I live here. I'm at the stadium occasionally. But I got to tell you, man, you know, that stuff is just about unwatchable to me. And you know, this is another conversation for another time, but baseball in general has become almost unwatchable for me, the style of play on the field, but especially the Orioles. And, I don't know how they attract even those minimal crowds, you know, they got last year.
Can I ask you, because I didn't know you well in the 90s. You were very connected to my friend Randy, who was connected to my business partner Steve at the time. And you and I were in press boxes everywhere because you were on the beat. I know I sat in – I remember seeing you at Fenway Park, Yankee Stadium, all during the run in the late 90s and Davey Johnson. How big a baseball – because you're such a varied guy. I mean, you got a band. You put out another album, and people are loving you up. And you're getting on planes flying all over the world, and you flush toilets in Sochi. And you know what I mean? Like, so I can talk to you about food, drinks, like the world, but like, I met you through baseball. Baseball was the first thing I knew, bro. Like, you know, I was a baseball family. It says Aparicio right here on the trailer. Like, it was my life. Baseball cards, playing baseball, playing wiffle ball. I won pitch, hit, and run right around the corner from your house at Patterson Park in 1976. I'm still looking for the damn plaque from Tom McCann. But baseball was my life. I don't know. Like, was it your life? I mean, did you grow up every day on it? Because you seem like a much more, and I mean this in a, I'm not being a dick, you're a much more worldly guy than me growing up in Dundalk, where my whole life was baseball, girls, and sports, like early on, and maybe a little bit of Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd that caught on afterward. But like, you have other interests. I had no other interest in my life. It is really weird for me to not like baseball anymore. And you know, I blew my back out. And you know this, last month I took needles in my back. This happened in October. My birthday's October 14th. So every year, the baseball playoffs, the World Series when I was a kid was the second week of October, not the second week of November. But I tried. Like, I was on my ass, Dave. I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. It hurt to even look at my phone because it hurt my back to do this, literally. Wow. So I'm laying in bed, 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 10 o'clock, Dodgers, Giants, Tampa, Boston. I couldn't watch it. I tried. I'll get into the World Cup next November. I'll be rooting for Tunisia. I watched Canada play in 12 degrees the other night in Edmonton, beating up on Mexico. Like, I like sports. I don't know what this is. Can you express to me your childhood baseball versus running home to watch the Royals play the Yankees and George Brett when I was a kid? Like, I couldn't watch it. It was terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Georgia. You know, I would venture to say it's not any more worldly where I grew up than Dundalk, maybe less so. This is rural Georgia. I was a fan of, you know, whatever sport was in season. And being down there in the height of, you know, I guess mostly the 80s, you know, I was probably more of an NBA fan than anything, only because the Atlanta Hawks were better than the Falcons or the Braves in those days. So I never had any particular attachment to baseball beyond any other sport. It happened to be the sport I fell into as a journalist.
Do you have a picture with the Dominique Wilkins statue in Atlanta?
Oh man. I mean, I had him on my wall. I had posters of him on my wall. Yeah, that was my guy, you know. I mean, Dominique, Dale Murphy, and, you know, maybe like, you know, Steve Bartkowski or something like that. Those were our heroes. But, you know, baseball, I did come to enjoy because as a journalist, it provided the most access to the players and the things that I'm in this for the stories. I'm not in this for the games. I'm not in this for the winners and losers of, you know, I'm in this for the stories, the people telling good stories, getting into somebody's life and profiling them. And baseball provided the best access of any sport. And that's maybe slipping away. And again, this is another conversation.
When you grew up wanting to be a sports writer, did you think baseball beat Washington Post? No, like you're a writer's writer. All I ever wanted to be was you. All I ever wanted was Rosenthal's job, Tom Keegan, you. All I ever wanted to do was be a fat slob, Oscar Madison in a press box, chasing Earl Weaver and Sparky Anderson spitting all over me with his shoes off. And like, I love that life in the 90s. I cannot watch it now. The NBA went there a long time ago for me too, where, I mean, I had NBA fantasy teams in the 80s with Clyde the Glide and, you know, like that era of the NBA, the late 80s, Dr. J's on his way out, Jordan's on his way in. I love the NBA. And then I found, like, I couldn't watch it. I couldn't watch the second quarter of a Bucks-Bulls game. I can't.
So what happened is that, you know, there's this dichotomy, there's this digression between what it takes to win and how smart we've become at pinpointing winning and losing versus the entertainment value of the sport. And so in baseball, every single development that has happened in the game is defensible on its own because it helps a team to win. So you take your starting pitcher out in the fourth inning. You want to bring in a parade of 97, 99 mile an hour throwing relievers starting in the fifth over and over and over and over. And you want to just focus on lifting the ball in the air because, you know, you can't get home runs on the ground. And so all of these things are defensible as ways to win games. But every single one of them erode the entertainment value of the sport. And so that's where we're at in baseball right now. The games are taking half an hour longer than they did 10 years ago. There's way too many dead periods. The pitch clock has to come into the game immediately, speed things up. So all of these trends are making it harder and harder to watch the games. And I can't sit through a full 9-inning baseball game on TV without having my phone around to check Twitter in between pitches or what, because attention spans are shrinking and the games are getting longer. So something has got to give.
Well, the storyline's not interesting. I wasn't interested in the people. I wasn't interested in Trump sitting in the outfield doing a chop. I wasn't interested in the cheating Astros. The managers don't really manage. I mean, there is no managing. There's just, what does the sheet tell me to do? So there's no strategy in that way. There's not even any guessing as to what's going to happen. And look, I'm not offended by gambling, right? I mean, I'm sponsored by the Maryland Lottery. I bet ponies. I've never really bet on football. They sort of frowned upon that when you were in the locker room. You know what I mean? Sort of being a tout or being around would be the end of your career as a writer, right? If you're putting 10 grand on a game because Billick told you Stoney Case isn't playing or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that was really frowned upon. Now it's clearly part of the business. Dave, playing the Bears, I've been on with Rick Tellender this week and Jim Lickie.
Oh, nice.
These really
nice.
Great people like you, people really great guests. And maybe I thought you were so worldly because you were a great writer, and that just led me to believe that you must have been raised on a different side of the farm than me. But I've never thought in my life that I wouldn't watch baseball. Dude, I did 30 ballparks in 30 days 6 years ago. I was in my late 40s when I cared enough to do that. Now I don't care enough to ever go to suburban Atlanta unless Billy Joel's playing there again or something. Like, I just, I'm done. And I don't know what, I'm 53. They can't afford for me to be done. John Angelos needs, even though they you know, they think I'm the village prick and like all that, they need 53-year-old guys named Aparicio in Baltimore to care about baseball. Major League Baseball needs Dave Shinen and, you know, they need us to care. And the gambling part is the part where they're opening our mouths and spooning it. And I'm like, dude, my whole life, I've never known even the most degenerate gamblers in my neighborhood. Tony Juki, the guys that bet the ponies, the guy that had the little flip cards where you bet on five college games for points and never into. There was never any baseball betting in my neighborhood or any neighborhood I've ever been in. No one ever bet on baseball. And if you did, you bet on starting pitching, which was a stupid concept to begin with. And now you don't even have that anymore. But this is where they – I mean, Wrigley, this is what they think they're going to build a casino next to the baseball stadium, and everybody's going to be putting action on whether the next pitch is a ball or a strike or a – I don't know. I don't know what the inducement to wager is going to be, but they think that's the pot of gold.
They do. And I tell you what, you know, they don't need 53-year-old me, you or me as much as they need 20-year-olds, you know? I mean, that's the generation they've lost. That generation is not turning to baseball the same way we did at that age, or kids for that matter. And the other thing going on with baseball is that we're a few weeks away from most likely another work stoppage. And I know it's going to be December and you're not going to be losing games, but if this bleeds over, this labor war bleeds over into the 2022 season and games start getting canceled, you're going to have another crisis in baseball of fans turning their back and this time maybe never coming back.
Well, I've had the Chicago people on and we were talking about interest in the game and where it is and, you know, ebbs and flows, and the Cubs won and then it's over with. Right. And they blow it up and how many teams are blowing it up. But more than that, I ran around with Maury Brown this week. I ran around with Eric Fisher this week. People that have covered baseball, like people like you who were around reading Lords of the Realm, chasing Gene Orza and Donald Fear and George Steinbrenner and Peter Angelos and Bud Selig and Dick Ravitch and all those names. And I watched the World Series, all the ancillary stuff that comes out of it, and Verducci and Rosenthal and The Athletic and all that. And all I see is baseball labor issues. And I'm like, they're at this again. And then I bring an old guy on like you. And then these other guys say to me, well, we haven't had a work stoppage in like 25 years. It's like, it's about time. And I'm like, it feels like they're always on strike. Maybe it's my lifetime and me being my age. And I admitted this to Maury and John Aran's going to come on. We're going to talk. I don't know anything about it. I knew every esoteric, and so did you, detail. But I knew every per diem they were fighting for in 1996, and player representatives and Messina and Jim Poole and Mark Williamson and, you know, all of Mark Belanger's still alive then and he's chirping. I don't know and I don't care. I don't even care who's playing at this point, let alone to know what billion-dollar pie they're fighting over. Do you even understand? I mean, do you follow it enough to explain it to me?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's basically the same thing as with the way the game is played on the field. It is that the smart people, the analytics have figured out, and the ultimate goal in baseball front offices is efficiency. They have figured out that you can beat free agency and you can beat arbitration by gaming the system in the same way that they've figured out how to game the game on the field. They figured out how to game free agency so that, you know, you basically just don't pay players in their 30s anymore. And so that way they never really make it to the big paydays. Now, of course, the superstars are still going to get paid. The Bryce Harpers are still going to sign their contracts and Mike Trouts and all those guys. But that middle class player who normally in 10 or 15 years ago would be cashing in a $75 million contract when he hits free agency, those guys don't get signed anymore. And so free agency has been eroded to the point where it's almost meaningless to a big portion of the baseball population of players. So they've, you know, that is the essence of this argument, is how free agency has been devalued. Teams are no longer trying to win. because it's more efficient for them economically to tank and get draft picks and rebuild around players making $500,000 a year, as opposed to spending on veterans for $15 million a year. So it's all been gamed by the smart people coming into the game.
Last thing on baseball, and then you and I'll get to something we care about. The notion that in the old days, and I mentioned Mark Belanger, and I mentioned all of these tough guys, you know, and Tony Clark's involved now, and there's different human beings. There's no Don Fear or whatever. The players destroyed the owners for 30 years because they were all a bunch of sour, miserable, wealthy pricks who would walk off and were willing to sell out because of Messersmith and because of Brooks Robinson and like all of that. I don't know what the temperature is for any of these guys to walk off or fight. I don't know if they're gunfight people or whether they are the way they are on the field, which is they'll throw at your chin, but then they'll go running and cheating and like all of the ethics part of this. But this is for big boys, and the owners in the old days were real salty old pricks that stuck together, and the players were saltier and stuck together. And that's how 81 happened. That's how my dad canceled the Sporting News because he was mad at all of them. That's how 94 happened, where you and I didn't have a gig other than chasing them around and watching Joe Smith dribble. We didn't have a football team here then. So I would just say this time around, I don't care about the money, the billions, the millions, the whatever. More of it's like, how prickly are their lawyers? How deep are they dug in? How stupid are they willing to be? And I go back all the way to a year and a half ago. We were in the middle of a plague, and they couldn't even make up their mind whether they wanted to play. And half the teams didn't want to play. And the ones that did, like the Orioles, didn't try anyway. And they didn't sell tickets. So I still like look at it. The players, the prickliest of players, guys like Curt Schilling that I knew really well, that liked to pop off about all this, would always say the real fight's between the owners, the rich owners and the poor owners. That's the fight. I don't know. I don't know how tough these guys are willing to be on either side. I don't know where the belly is for war right now. I know, boy, they used to have it. They used to hate each other, and they love the war part of it, as far as I could tell back in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time that in the 90s, it was, you know, World War III. And then there became a nice period of labor peace when Michael Wiener was still alive running the union. And he and Rob Manfred had a very solid professional relationship where you had the feeling that they were on the same side in many ways in terms of growing the game. And now we're back into the antagonism. It is about as bad as it was back in the 90s right now.
Really?
Yeah, things are really, really bad.
No, so 10 years ago when I started to take a nap and the Orioles started to take – they were 15 years into a nap and my wife got sick and I fell away from labor issues. I guess the issue was they were making so much money, right? The TV, the Masson deal and the BAM revenue just made baseball flush in a way that there was enough money to – because there was always enough money to fight over. You know what I mean? Like, right?
Yeah, and a couple of things have happened. I mean, number one, in the last labor deal, it's widely viewed that the union ceded some economic ground to the owners in the name of creature comforts for the players. So the players demanded things like, you know, extra seats on planes and suites on the road and all these creature comfort things, and they gave back some economic ground. The union disputes that characterization, but it certainly looks that way on the face of the deal that was signed, that happened, and that there is now some, you know, buyer's remorse, and now the union is you know, on the war path to gain back some economic ground. So that's one thing that happened. You know, obviously this particular work stoppage is not going to be a strike. It's going to be a lockout because the owners have the leverage right now in the off season when the players are looking to sign contracts. A strike obviously happens in the season where the players have the leverage and they cancel games, which hurts the owner's bottom line. So we haven't gotten to that point. Now, does either side have the stomach for that? You know, I don't know. I don't know if the players have the stomach to walk off from regular season games. But, you know, I don't see any signs at all right now that there is a bridge that can be built between the sides to get this thing over with in a quick fashion. I see this bleeding over at least through the entire offseason.
He writes great words. He writes great songs as well. Dave Shine, it's been my friend for 3 decades. He's at the Washington Post. You can follow him out on the Twitter thing as well. That's S-H-E-I-N-I-N. And we're going to talk about your rock and roll in a minute. But before we do that, you went to one of my favorite places on earth. I love Tokyo. I don't know what your experience was with the mask, with things open, closed, with being from another place, with being a prensa and a journalist over in Tokyo. But roll me through, dude. When'd you leave? When'd you come back? How were the noodles? I love Tokyo. I love Japan.
Well, I take your word for it. I didn't really get to see it. I'd love to get back there and actually see the place. Yeah, the Olympics were held under a strict COVID regimen. I mean, we had to get tested twice here in the States within 96 hours of our flight. One test within 96 hours, one test within 72 hours, had to test negative to get on the flight. We were held at the Tokyo airport for 3 or 4 hours while they did another test, COVID test. You had to download these apps onto your phone where your movements were tracked and your health status was tracked. You had to spit into a tube daily for your first 4 or 5 days down there. And then every third or fourth day, I can't remember.
Sounds like they took the plague seriously over there, huh?
It took it very seriously, and they were in a state of emergency. Japan was in the largest spike of the entire pandemic around the time the Olympics started. So it was a really weird time. We were not allowed to go anywhere for the first 14 days in the country. No public transportation, no eating in restaurants, no going out. So it was very restrictive, and I barely got to see any of the city. After 14 days, I was freed up a little bit, got to ride the bullet train one day to an assignment and saw a little bit of the country, but very, very little. I ate a lot of Uber Eats, delivered to my hotel because we couldn't go to restaurants. It was very unfortunate. I felt like I could really love that country and that city, but I didn't get to experience the flavor of it.
Man, the lights of Shinjuku and Shibuya and Olympics are back, right? I mean, and yes. Quickly, right? And it's certainly in that part of the world, you're about to fly 14 more hours to another place where I had a pretty good time in Beijing when I was over there with Cal Ripken back in 07. They were welcoming the 08 Olympics at that time. And I went over with the State Department. Rick Mace, one of your compadres, it was our traveling buddy, along with John Maroon. So we all came down the Great Wall of China together. I would highly recommend that you do that. Take the toboggan down Moteng Yu. But so you're going over, and the Olympics are adjusting to this, the money around it, the TV, the athletes, everything that went on with the gymnastics program. I mean, all that you were on, and here we go again to Beijing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really quick turnaround. Normally, it's 2 years or 18 months at least. And in this case, because of the one-year postponement of Tokyo, we have 6 months to get ready for Beijing. And now it's about 2 months away. I was there in Beijing in 2008 for those Summer Olympics. I had a good time, saw the Great Wall of China in August, which is very different than, February. and left there thinking, I'm good. I'm glad I saw this place. I never really want to go back, but yet here we are 14 years later.
So you were at the bird's nest in the opening ceremonies, all that?
Yeah. Yeah. I was at the opening ceremonies. I covered some track and field. I didn't do any swimming that year, which is unfortunate because that was Michael Phelps's probably, best Olympics. It was a good Olympics. I enjoyed it. It was my first Olympics. Here we are going back. As bad as Tokyo was in terms of the restrictions, China is going to be even worse. We're told there's going to be daily testing there for COVID, throat swabs every day. You're going to be in a strict bubble where there's not even a 14-day light at the end of the tunnel where you can get out and explore. You're going to be in a hard bubble the entire time. Now, in a professional sense, that could be better because we might actually get face-to-face access to athletes, which we didn't have in Tokyo because of COVID. Everything was Zoom or mixed zone from a distance. So it could be a little bit better professionally, but you know, personally, it's going to be kind of a nightmare.
Feels like a military assignment a little bit.
I don't want to compare it to that because,
well, not active duty, but sort of behind, you know, behind the scenes. And look, covering the Super Bowl has become this thing where they put a wall up like that in Houston. Yeah. After, you know, when Trump took the country over, literally, yeah, you could see the differences that it became this walled arsenal thing that they talked about. This is what they do at the Olympics. And I'm like, oh, so the Olympics aren't fun, huh? And you know, and then I go back to Atlanta in 96, which was the one that I almost went to. Like, I mean, my buddy had a flight, and we were going to sneak down there and stay at the Quality Inn, and the bombings happened that weekend. And we're going back 25 years now. But I would think the Olympics at this point, from a journalist standpoint, it's a compelling story, but it's also, so, and certainly going to Beijing at this point with where China is with Taiwan. And I remember all that from 07. When you're in China, you're not allowed to say the word Taiwan. That is offensive to Chinese people.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you, you know, I was really grumpy in Tokyo when I first got there. I was like, you know, I felt like Japan didn't want us there, and the IOC was shoving the Olympics down the throats of the Japanese people. They were in the middle of a national emergency with the pandemic. It felt like we were very much unwanted. I was questioning, why are we here? Why are we doing this when Japan doesn't want it? And then I have to say, you know, the athletes saved it for me. You know, I mean, if you think about this on the athletes' behalf, you know, you come to realize why it matters. You know, the athletes, there are tens of thousands of athletes there who have, you know, worked their entire lives.
And they are literally the best athletes in the world. We talk about the NBA and golfers and all this. These are people who throw javelins, who do things in anonymity, who, you know, literally, and this is their chance. Right.
And they deserve that, you know, and if you focus on that, which I'm going to try to do in China, you know, you understand why we're there. And I'm as cynical as anybody, and I know why we're really there is so that NBC can put on a TV show for 17 nights. Same thing as in the Summer Games. Excuse me. But I also can appreciate the athletes' stories, and that's what I'm going to try to focus on in China, same way I did ultimately in Tokyo. It's about the athletes and those amazing stories, and I'm going to tell them as best I can.
You're writing better songs because of all this for your album, or you know, some of this inspiration? I mean, I was over in Japan right before the plague. We think we may have contracted a little bit of the COVID thing on our way back, but you know, music has been the thing I've missed the most. I saw a Cheap Trick show at the Warner Theater, and I didn't see a show for a year and a half. And this summer, I sort of overloaded and binged on Meriwether and Pier 6 and Anywhere. I saw Marcus King over at the Soundstage when I could barely stand. Nice. Yeah, I've been into it and into music, and for people locked down, and I stopped by and darkened your porch in the middle of the plague with you and your wife, and you got a guitar there, and I see the guitar behind you, that for musicians and being shut down, it was time well spent if you used the creativity, right?
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, for me, where it's kind of like my side gig, it was a productive time for sure. But all my friends who are in the music industry and trying to make it in the industry, it was a dark, dark time. And it still is, because shows have not come back fully. You know, my friends are struggling, man. You know, musicians are struggling. If you're out there and you're thinking about, you know, you know some musicians in your life, you know, hug your musician friends, buy their merchandise, buy a t-shirt, you know, go online and stream a show. If they're doing a streaming show, go to a live show, buy physical records, albums, LPs, CDs, even, you know, my musicians are hurting, man. And, you know, it was already on the downswing because of the streaming economy, which does not pay the artists for their recordings the way that physical or even MP3s did back in the day. So musicians were hurting already, and the pandemic has crushed them. And so, you know, do what you can for your musician friends. And I love that you're going out to see shows. I'm doing the same thing starting back, you know, and that's the best way to support music.
Tip your servers, as I say. Tell everybody about the album and then come on, man. I mean, we got to talk music here.
Yeah, album just came out this month, a couple weeks ago. It's called The Measure of Things. I'm really high on it. I think it's a great record. I'm really proud of it. Had some great, you know, Baltimore-based friends who helped me with it. Andrew Grimm from June Star, Andy Bopp, who's longtime power pop legend in Baltimore, helped out with it. Jay Robbins, who was the lead singer of Jawbox back in the day. He runs a studio called Magpie Cage, downtown Baltimore. That's where we mixed it. Phenomenal musicians played on the record, and I'm really, really proud of it. WTMD played a song off of it last night. I was happy about that.
I got Sam Sessa on the show next week. Just so you know, I booked Sam.
Oh, there
on.
You go. Yeah. He's the one who played my song last night.
Well, Sam and I, Sam says, what are we going to talk about? He doesn't know I'm going to have him sing holiday songs with me. Don't tell him.
Okay. I'll keep that between us. But yeah, it's a good record. It's called The Measure of Things.
Buy, download. How do we support you?
I mean, you know, you can stream it anywhere. Of course, you know, physical copies are better. MP3s. You can download it on my Bandcamp site, DaveShinen.bandcamp.com. But yeah, I just want to get it out there. So anywhere you want to listen to it, stream it. Get out there and do it. It's on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, Deezer, all those things. And it's a good record.
Nice. Well, I have it right up here. The Measure Things by Dave Shinen. You can find it. Download digital albums. Why Wouldn't I? St. Paul, Champagne in Chicago, Broken But Brilliant, all of it up. And can still read your work at the Washington. Just Olympics for you. No baseball, no football. I mean, I had Ken Belson on 2 weeks ago. I had Dave Steele on. We were talking about these NFL owners fighting with each other. The Kroenke indemnity brings back all of my Mayor Hudnut and Bob Irsay stories from 1984, you know?
Man, good Lord. Yeah. It all rings a bell to me as well.
You're just Olympics though right now.
I mean, at this very moment I am, but that's not to say that this winter I might not dive into some other things. I'm working on some Olympic type of projects right now to get ready into the paper for Beijing. But yeah, you know, I'll be all over the map. You know, you just never know.
Might run into him outside the Royal Farm, a couple blocks from his house down on Fleet Street. We had lottery winners last week. Dave Shinen, he's been my friend a long time. He writes things for the Washington Post. He writes songs for your enjoyment. You can find him out at Bandcamp and get The Measure of Things as well. And I hope to see you at Patterson Park over pizza and a beer or crab cake sometime soon, brother, all right?
That would be outstanding.
I mean, you're not going to be allowed to talk to people in China. You better take advantage of it now, all right?
Let's do it.
Yeah. We'll eat some Chinese food. That's what we'll do.
Is there a good Chinese in Baltimore? I don't know.
Dude, I'm taking you down to Young's Carry Out. We're going to get some carry out. I'll bring you some. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll get you some spring rolls. We'll take care of it. Dave Shinen from the Washington Post joining us here. We're back out on the road doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery on Black Friday. We will be in Abingdon at Conrad's Crabs. I've had Conrad's Crabs. I've never had Conrad's Crab Cake. So we're going to do that with Harford County Executive. Barry Glassman is going to be joining us amongst others. I think Eric Sauer from There Goes My Hero is going to be joining us because we're up in his neighborhood. Harford County, we're coming on Black Friday. Bring me some leftover mincemeat pie and figgy pudding, please. On the 3rd of December, we will be at Pappas in Cockeysville. Leonard Raskin's excited about that. My buddy Jim Rees from Offutt Kerman's going to be joining us, as well as some other dignitaries and the big crab cake at Pappas. It is the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. Hope you join us. And my 30th anniversary kicks off at the Beaumont in Catonsville on the 9th. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, talking Ravens football, Olympics, baseball, and rock and roll. We're BaltimorePositive.com.